All right, welcome to America This Week. I'm Matt Taibbi.
And I'm Walter Kern.
So, all right, so we're going to dive into our favorite subject, Israel and Palestine and the protests here in the States, and a number of things that have happened in rapid succession that are alarming, including a bill that just passed in Congress that seems remarkable on many levels. But maybe we should just start with the whole question of why we haven't talked about this bill so much in the, or this issue so much in the past. Do you want to start? Or, I mean, I'm happy to go there, but,
Well, yeah,
I think we feel similarly. Yeah.
Yeah. I'll let you start.
Okay. So I've seen a lot of criticism. I've seen people going after me online and on social media talking about how I must be afraid, even as an independent, to talk about this issue because I'm afraid of Israel. Like, are you kidding? Fuck Israel. I'm not afraid to talk about any issue. And then, you know, there's a secondary thing that comes after that where people think, well, it must be a financial motivation. You know, you're afraid to, you make money from subscribers. You're afraid to offend X number of people who subscribe to you. So you don't want to talk about the issue, and you're, you know, on this issue, you're going to lose some people who feel very strongly about it, no matter, you know, what your opinion is. But that's not really true either. Like, for somebody like me, the way you lose financially in, you know, commentary as well as journalism is to be wrong about something. Right. And the big reason that I don't talk about Israel and Palestine is because I don't fully understand it. Like, I can react emotionally to seeing the bombing of civilians, you know, as well as the terrorist attacks. But there's 100 years of history. There's a million moving parts. There are, you know, things that have happened in the last 20 years, efforts to construct a two-state solution that have failed, the introduction of Hamas as a player into all this. Like, there's just tons of background that I don't know. I don't feel on solid ground talking about a lot of these things. So it's just not something that I willy-nilly feel like diving into. This job is about being careful with words. And so when I have something I feel confident in saying, I'll say it, but that's the reason that that I don't like this issue. But that, and there's another element to the story, which I think is unique, which is that the people on both sides of this issue I don't like the way either of them talk about the other. And there is an emotional tenor to this entire affair that makes it difficult to even ask questions without people accusing you of being on the wrong side. Mm-hmm. And I don't like that. And we're going to get into some of that because we're going to talk about what's happened with the protests here in the States. And you can see how the attitudes around debating this issue have turned in kind of a dark direction all around. And that has made me nervous. I've been assigned to cover this story a couple of times and have always been leery of the way activists involved with this issue talk about it. And so it makes me uncomfortable. I don't feel confident about the history. I've never been there. So that's part of it for me. But Walter, how about you?
Well, I mean, first of all, the show is called America This Week, not Israel This Week. But I think we've decided to cover this because that has come home to America. I mean, with these protests. And so I think it's appropriate. But like you, I've never been to Israel. I've never been to Gaza. I don't consider myself a student of the conflict, though it's been going on in the background all my life. You know, I've been aware of it in some form or another, not necessarily the Gaza conflict, but Israel's wars with its neighbors. You know, to make a confession or just a simple acknowledgement of personal history, I grew up in the 70s at a time when Israel was under siege and was quite celebrated in the American press as a kind of holdout against regional terrorism and so on. I mean, terrorism, as I knew it before the 9/11 style, was the hijacking of planes.
Right, Munich,
And you know, Munich, the PLO killing
Black athletes. September.
Exactly. So I will freely acknowledge that I was predisposed to the Israeli side of this argument as a young man. I've tried to educate myself, but as time has gone on, but not sufficiently to have real clear beliefs and prescriptions about the situation. But since October 7th, and especially since the Israeli incursion into Gaza, I've realized that it's an unavoidable topic. It's now polarizing people here. And I'm willing to wade in, but with the proviso that I don't weigh in from a stance of expertise. I'm learning as everybody else is, I suppose.
Well, yes and no, because maybe we don't have expertise about Israel and Palestine, but when we start moving into speech in America,
right,
and you know what is and isn't part of our tradition, what is and isn't acceptable, what, you know, what's good and what's bad, you know, that's an area where I feel much more comfortable talking about. I understand the laws, I understand the history.
Sure.
I probably come at this.
Yeah, me too. And that's one of the reasons that I think we agreed to do this, because it's starting to impinge on freedoms and rights in America in a way that I think is not just worthy of comment, but obliges us to comment if we're to be consistent with past conversations and positions we've taken.
Right. And just to cop to something in the same way that you did. I probably came at this from a slightly different direction than you did. I mean, I grew up, you know, I'm a little bit younger, and I was probably much more leaning in the direction of sympathizing with Palestine. I had Palestinian friends when I studied overseas in St. Petersburg as a young person. So, you know, I heard a lot of stories back then, and my general inclination about this issue has always been to, you know, toward condemning the blockade. Also, you know, Israel has really been a pioneer in the development of sort of the model of modern digital censorship. Mm-hmm. I mean, Glenn Greenwald did one of the earliest stories about this in 2015, where he talked about Facebook making a deal with you know, the Israeli government and the Mossad, where basically 95% of the requests that the Mossad made to Facebook for moderation were honored. And, you know, from what I understand, Facebook was really one of the only ways that people can communicate in Gaza. They don't have very many press organs that really work. There's significant digital censorship of, outlets like the Electronic Intifada, right? And so this is a big deal. And that basic arrangement that they had, which was, if you want to make money having Facebook in Israel, this is the price that you're going to pay. You're going to allow us to control content that means a lot to us. And I think since then, a lot of you've seen that model replicated in to various degrees in other countries, and it's starting to come a little bit to the United States. So that's another area where I've always looked at this issue and thought, the Palestinians have been, the canary in the coal mine when it comes to modern censorship tools. They're like the testing ground for how all these things work. So that's true. But leaving all that aside, yeah, you're right. It's now come back to our shores. And this week and last week, this story has exploded domestically in a way that it really hadn't before, with both sort of takeovers of college, not takeovers, encampments on college campuses that have garnered a tremendous amount of attention. And then, should we start with the House bill? Because that's the reaction to all of this has been really amazing. I mean, there have been things that have gone on both sides, but the official reactions.
I think we should start with the House bill because it affects everyone. Depending on whether you live anywhere near an Ivy League campus, you may or may not care, or UCLA, you may or may not care about what's going on the campuses. But this is a bill to manage the speech of all Americans. And it's, for me, a bill that sets a terrible precedent besides being bad in itself. It takes an entire topic, the discussion of Israel and, Jews in general, I guess, and attempts to set parameters for our discussion of it. They're very vague parameters in some cases, and they, to me, are stupendously unconstitutional. To make a kind of constitution for how you can talk about Israel and then enforce it is unprecedented to me.
Yeah. So, and we can talk about this too in a minute, but the House bill, which, what did it pass? It passed 320 to 91, by the way, which is unbelievable. But let's just hear how they're selling it first. Mm-hmm. This is a CBS report on the bill.
On Capitol Hill, the House Rules Committee advanced a bipartisan bill that aims to define anti-Semitism. A House vote on the legislation is expected this week, and it could not only reignite division among Democrats, but also impact student protests against the war in Gaza on campuses around the U.S. Nicole Killian is on the Hill for us and joins us now to discuss. So, Nicole, let's talk about the impact that this legislation could have on the protests.
Well, I don't know that there will be an immediate impact simply because this is a bill that is now making its way through the House. There is a companion bill in the Senate. We don't know how quickly they will move this legislation per se. But as you mentioned, this does modify the working definition of anti-Semitism, holds it to a more stricter standard when it comes to enforcing anti-discrimination laws, potentially, which could have an impact on the type of language, for instance, that is used in some of these protests. But again, I would not expect any kind of immediate impact, although this bill is likely to clear the House. But that being said, there are a number of efforts underway in both chambers. We know later today, for instance, Speaker Johnson is set to announce a House-wide crackdown, to use the Speaker's terms, when it comes to combating anti-Semitism on college campuses.
Okay, so we get the idea with that, right? But more specifically, there are like 9 things about this that are terrifying. They're essentially going to bar certain kinds of speech on university campuses. It's going to have the department and put it on the Department of Education to enforce anti-discrimination laws. And, you know, the definition of what anti-Semitism will be could be things as vague as, you know, denying Jewish, you know, claiming that the existence of the state of Israel is racist, you know, using certain symbols and images, drawing comparisons of Israeli policy to that of Nazis. That's the same thing that happened to C.J. Hopkins, you know, the playwright in in Germany. He's in trouble for comparing basically modern authorities to Nazis, but using a swastika. But similarly, there was an executive order passed in Texas by Texas Governor Greg Abbott, and this also has created a state definition of anti-Semitism that will now be enforced. Here's the executive order, and here's a phrase that you're going to hear a lot in the coming weeks. Texas supports free speech, but you're going to hear that over and over again. Mike Johnson said it this week too, the Speaker of the House. We support free speech, but free speech comes with responsibilities. And then they basically outline a series of things that, you know, they will define as anti-Semitic, that won't be allowed on Texas universities, like phrases like from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free, and so on. So, Walter, how do you feel about any state definition of an idea being barred?
I don't feel good about it at all. I mean, to think that individual phrases are being outlawed in America is shocking. And these bills will not just apply to university discourse, which should be the freest of any place. I mean, in other words,
right,
how upside down is it to start at universities censoring ideas? They should be the last place that censorship should reach, if it, you know, if it exists at all. But in any case, we're now going to have like George Carlin saying that there were 7 words you couldn't say on television. They're going to be 15 phrases you can't say on campus. But it's a terrible trend. I don't understand why they think this is the problem. What is this unique challenge called anti-Semitism that we have to throw over the Constitution for? You know, I have Jewish friends, including strenuously pro-Israel friends, who are appalled by this. I think it bothers them that something is being done in their name that is so offensive to the American spirit. And I can understand that. If I were Jewish and pro-Israel, I doubt that I would want to have to answer for this bill. Which looks like special pleading and a carve out, and kind of, I think, has a reverse effect, making you think, this lobby must be particularly influential. How many groups get federal laws that bar criticism of them?
Yeah, how many get to send a missile directly into the First Amendment,
right,
you know, in a week or whatever it is, right? I mean, it's pretty intense. And boy, was it predictable that the Republicans who, you know, for the last 3 or 4 years stamped their feet up and down and played in the role of free speech absolute, has suddenly come out and they want to bar hate speech, which was exactly the opposite position that they had, you know,
I've long been sympathetic to the idea that hate speech laws can indeed, through mission creep, become chilling to discourse in general. I think that's a legitimate concern. And here we go, because this is not hate speech. It's sort of intellectual speech. They're banning ideas and calling them hate speech. This is the fruit of what the Republicans warned about, and yet they're embracing it. Nothing scares me more now, Matt, than something that has bipartisan support in the U.S. Congress, where, you know, the worst of the intolerant left and right get together to, you know, whatever, broaden FISA or, you know, ban TikTok and now Israel. Do people not see that we are answering every challenge in the same way with censorship? I mean, it's their only answer anymore. Well, you know, it might be bad, but don't talk about it. You know, get social media to suppress it. So I'm shocked that the Republicans, shocked, unshocked, would go from a kind of principled and somewhat unpopular position on these hate speech laws to championing the worst of them.
Yeah, and not only that, there has been this amazing, seemingly seamless transition from being absolutely appalled, taking one side of this sort of culture war and being appalled at the fragility of, you know, the woke campus culture, and then turning right around and embracing it again. You know, I think the most ridiculous example of that, you know, we can see in this episode involving a student at Yale who claimed to be stabbed in the eye, and our own Matt Orfalia made a video, and we can just watch part of it, but I think it's worth showing a little bit of, because all of the same catchphrases that that the right wing and conservative media has screeched about for years are suddenly appearing, and, you know, with the backing of the same organization. So let's just listen to the story a little bit.
Israel protests turning violent. Our next guest saying, quote, "I was stabbed in the eye.
Stabbed for being a Jew."
There's a video on my Twitter.
We will not stop. We will not rest. We will not stop. We will not rest.
See, I can't move forward.
We will not rest. Divest. We will not stop. We will not rest. Disclose. Divest. We will not stop. We will not rest.
Disclose. Divest.
And here it comes.
No, a complete embellishment.
One Jewish student at Yale was stabbed in the eye with a Palestinian flag.
Oh, come on.
Stabbing students in the eye with flags.
Stabbed in the eye with a Palestinian flag.
Saying that her eye had been messed up.
That she was assaulted.
Stabbed in the eye with an anti-Israel protester's flag.
Wow. A demonstrator jammed a Palestinian flag into her left eye.
Jabbed in the eye with a Palestinian flag.
Stabbed in the eye with a Palestinian flag.
Yale's investigating the attack.
Having her
eye stabbed with a Palestinian flag. Yes. So there's a lot of violence going on.
Injuring our guest.
Poked in the eye with a flag and hospitalized.
You had to receive hospital treatment for your injury. It's a heart attack, needed hospital treatment for that injury.
What is the nature of your injury?
I could just feel the pressure of what happened and like I have a headache.
Oh boy.
Sahar Tartak says she was assaulted for wearing Jewish attire.
Quite obvious. I wear a modest dress and I have a Star of David. Quite obvious. And they identified us pretty much immediately.
Then what happened?
There's a video on my Twitter of students passing by me in a circle as they encircled me, singing and dancing against the Jewish people. And they all, one after the other, taunted me. One after the other.
I think we get the idea, but so there's like a bunch of things here. I mean, this is all, you know, how many articles did we read in the National Review, in Fox, in the New York Post about students who were made to feel, who were traumatized or, you know, made to feel harmed or felt threatened because somebody said a bad thing to them. I mean, the New York Post last year ran this story bashing San Francisco State University for saying that the whole campus trans community was traumatized by the presence of an all-American swimmer who didn't believe that trans women should be allowed to compete. And now here we have somebody who's saying, you know, I was encircled. I was to one after, it wasn't just one person who taunted me. They all taunted me. And then also additionally, sort of draping yourself in literally in the cloak of marginalized victimhood. I thought that was a thing that conservatives were against. But you saw sort of story after story about this and I don't know. I'm curious to hear your thoughts about that, too.
I loved that the New York Times specified that it was her left eye. They did a deep dive. No, yeah, I wanted to know which
heavy
eye.
Reporting.
Only they answered it. Well, not to make light of the fact she was stabbed in the eye, though her eyes looked okay. I mean, stabbed suggests something happened to the eyeball. I expected her to have a patch, but I'm not suggesting she's not telling the truth. I may suspect that it was slightly exaggerated.
Or inadvertent.
Right. And, you know, as they say in Hollywood screenwriting, it's a little on the nose to not just be stabbed, but be stabbed with a Palestinian flag.
Right. And you saw that, you know, it goes from it happened inadvertently to somebody going like this. It goes from, you know, one flag to flags, student to students, you know. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Right. I will say, though, that in seeing the footage of these various protests, it does seem to me that there is often a hostility evinced by the protesters toward Jews in general, and that they've also been given to blockades I would call it violent scuffling with others. The other night when the protesters broke into the administration building at Columbia and, you know, broke out windows and so on, there were a couple guys who stood up to them. And one of them in the video is carried away by protesters. They grab him, bear hug him, and take him away. So to me, that's not speech. You know, inhibiting people's freedom of movement, breaking windows, bear hugging them and carrying them off, those kind of things are not protected actions. In fact, they're probably in many cases crimes.
But yeah, no, it's the opposite. Mm-hmm. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, yeah. But yeah, exactly. I mean, one of the reasons that we celebrate speech and protect freedom of speech, those who are classically, trained to believe it's important, like me, is that it is an alternative to violence. It may even be a thing that prevents it, that airs and vents our conflicts in a reasonable way rather than a physical way. And so I think that it's important not to confuse speech and bullying, basically, or sort of mass action to, you know, keep people from going places, doing things. And